Okay, so this is you're in the Meet the Fed 2.0 panel. So how many people in the audience are feds that will admit it? What a coincidence. That's really strange. How many are foreign spies? How many here are doing counter intel on the, no. So the genesis of this panel was the old Meet the Fed panel that we've had for many years and is very successful. And for a number of scheduling reasons and some screw-ups and everything, that panel didn't happen this year. But it was perfect because I wanted to try something new. I wanted to try sort of a Meet the Fed 2.0. So I wanted to get the guys actually running the investigations, the guys with the badges and the guns and the arrest authority and people that are chasing down, you know, looking at packet logs, to actually tell us, like, hey, what's it really like? What's going on? You know, do you sleep at all? Do you fly all over the country? What's it like to actually be trying to protect these networks? And so I got my friend here, Darren, who I met when he wasn't in the OSI, and then later on he went back. He was an agent. He thought the private industry might be for him, and then you were like, I'm running back. So he's back, and he knows everybody. His nickname is the mayor. Yep, see, it's out. It's out, man. And he's assembled a great team of guys representing different agencies who are active. And he's going to kind of do a little interaction with them. We have a microphone up here for questions. We want to make this very just transparent. Ask whatever's on your mind after everybody kind of gives a background. And that's about it. It's pretty simple. It's straightforward. And I want to introduce Darren. So come on up here, man.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Thank you, Jeff. Well, thank you all for coming to Meet the Fed 2.0. As Jeff said, I'm Darren Hartvigson, and I'm an OSI special agent. I've been in OSI for 16 years, spent a year out in the corporate world, and came back about a year and a half ago. So I appreciate the opportunity to change a little bit on how we interact with DEF CON in a federal agent context. But as Jeff said, this is something new, and if you have worked with federal agents at all, you know we don't beta test stuff. So we're winging this, and it's either going to crash or succeed. So, but it's going to be up to you on whether it succeeds. It's based on interaction with the audience, and so once we get into the panel discussion, if you would think of good questions to ask current operators about their job and how they go about being federal agents. So what's the agenda? We're going to start out first in line with tradition and start out with a game. And then we're going to go into the panel. But the game that we used to play in Meet the Fed was called Spot the Lamer, but I changed it up a little. I want to do a legit Spot the Fed. So what we're going to do is have four individuals come up to the stage, and one of them is actually a current operator. Then we're going to have four volunteers from the audience who, one, say, really cool shirt that says, I spotted the Fed, ask questions, and one of those four, whoever picks the real Fed, will get a shirt. So let's kick that off, but before we kick that off, we have to sort of define what a Fed is. A Fed in our context is a federal agent with a badge gun running cyber operations and investigations. As DEF CON got popular and as hackers got together and conspired to overflow buffers, agents have always wanted to be in that mix to figure out what the hackers were doing. So as a practical matter, hackers had to sort of judge their audience, who they're hanging out with, and they wanted to spot the federal agent. And it's now evolved into sort of a game, and it's a game that we're going to play now. So, if Billy, if you could bring up our supposed agents. So come on up here, stand next to Jeff, and come on up here, stand right next to Jeff, and maybe he'll even shake your hand and be nice. Come on, stand right here, please. So now I need four volunteers from the audience that want a shirt. So Billy, if you would help me out there, and make sure they don't you know, they're not already like feds. If you could stand over here by the mic, that would be great. Yeah, no, sir? Sir? Because, yeah, the girls are up here. No, uh-uh. Yeah, right over there by the mic. So, stand right there. So this is how it's going to work. You guys get one question, and you get to ask them, hey, yeah, girls, yeah, no, over here, guy. Sir, over here? Yeah, there you go. So you guys get one question, and you get to ask the ladies one question, and they all have to answer that one question. And then when you all four are done with your one question, then you get to tell Billy who you think the Fed is. And if one of you is right, you win. If you're all wrong, then you get to ask another question. Is that cool? Easy, right? So who's first?
What kind of question?
You can ask anything. They're authorized to lie, and so you can ask whatever you want to ask.
Are you a Fed?
Fed?
No. 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 No.
Okay, next.
Have you ever studied non-Morse intercepts?
What did you guys want to be when you grew up, when you were little?
What?
What did you guys always want to do when you grew up, when you were little? Like, what was your dream job?
What did you want to be when you were growing up?
A princess.
Princess, yeah, that's good.
A doctor. A school counselor.
A pilot.
Okay.
One was a princess, one was a doctor.
School counselor.
School counselor.
Who is your favorite president?
So here.
Tough call. Clinton. Reagan. Clinton.
Okay. So do you guys have do you have an idea who it is? So tell Billy in private, and then and then we'll see if we have a winner. No, you got to commit, man. No, don't point. Okay. So that wasn't private either. Remember. Okay. So why don't you go and talk to Billy in private? Okay. Next. Thinking. Okay, do we have a winner? Two winners. Okay. So let's see if the audience is as good as our two winners. Okay, I'll carry it. I'm not going to step this guy. Okay, I'm going to get behind our contestants. And so the audience, this one. What's that? Okay. Jeff says show of hands, so let's do that. Show of hands. Okay. This young lady? Okay. Ma'am? Oh. Wow. Okay. How about this young lady? Wow. Wow, okay. So... Ask which one why, Jeff.
Why are you so positive
on those two? I can see her handcuffs. Maybe that's a bad idea. Posture, handcuffs, facial expressions, answers. Well, guess what? Guess what? The majority of you, the ones who picked her, were wrong. No wonder why we are so successful here. So, if I could have if my two winners come up here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not Britney Spears. I don't know how to do this. So why'd you pick who you picked?
I asked why, what they want to be when they grew up, and she said a pilot, so that was a red flag military.
Absolutely. What about you?
When I asked who was president, I knew that this was a plant. So. I knew Reagan was going to be a plant.
Oh, really? Okay, that's good. Well,
I like Reagan.
Well,
no,
if you would, Amanda, step up. This is Amanda. Amanda is currently an OSI agent. She's running some of our most significant ops and is here to represent OSI, and thank you so much. We don't get to go yet. So what's your name, by the way?
Patrick Wright.
Thanks for playing, man. I got a shirt for you.
Van.
Okay. And ladies, thank you so much for playing. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And in tradition, the folks that spotted the Fed get a shirt that says, I spotted the Fed, and then the Fed gets a shirt that says, I am the Fed. So, thank you, Amanda. Appreciate it. It's a good sport. Oh, you can talk. So now we get into the panel, and thank you so much, Jeff. But now we get into the panel discussion. The panel discussion is really you. You get to interact with a federal agent. If you've never done that before, it can be an experience. But think about it as if you're introduced to these young men for the first time and you want to ask them a question, approach it like that. But what I'm going to ask them to do individually is introduce themselves, introduce what agency they're from, and maybe talk about their mission a little bit. And then once we're done with that, I'll open it up for questions. So think about good questions, and we'll start off with Adam. Sir.
Yes, my name is Adam, and I'm an investigator for the Air Force, Office of Special Investigations. And I've been with the Air Force now about 10 years, been with investigations for about half that. And I'm an active service member, very proud of my military service. Very happy for all of you in the audience that are service members, government, active duty, civilians, reservists, etc. I see a lot of you out there, and I just thank you for all your service. I'm very proud to serve alongside you, whether we've worked together or not. I thank you, and I look forward to our dialogue this morning. So.
My name's Ahmed. I'm with NASA's Computer Crime Division in Southern California. We're in Pasadena. I've been with NASA for just a little over a year now. Before that, I spent just under a decade in the Air Force, half of that time with OSI, where I actually worked with Adam and Darren for a few years. Our mission area is a typical computer crime mission set, you know, the computer intrusions, child exploitation cases, typical forensic support to white-collar crime-type cases. We do it all out of our shop, and I'd say most of our time is spent investigating computer intrusions, which is probably of most interest to most of you in the room, so we can chat about that as you wish. Glad to be here.
My name's Adam as well. I'm with NCIS out of Washington State. I've been with NCIS for about 5 years, and prior to that I was with the U.S. Customs Service as a special agent, which has now become DHS ICE. I just got back from a couple of years overseas where I focused mainly on criminal forensics, not so much the network side. Any child pornography, fraud, if you died suspiciously, went through your computer, try to figure that out. Now I'm back here in the States and starting to get into the network intrusion side.
My name is Ryan. I'm the Assistant Special Agent in charge for Army CID's Digital Forensics and Research Branch with our Computer Crime Investigative Unit. Much like these guys, we are very network intrusion heavy, but we do a lot of other things involving all manner of things that are of interest to the Army and Department of Defense, from child exploitation to human trafficking to terrorism to all kinds of things. So we have an investigative mission, but we also do a lot of our own forensic stuff, the bits and the bytes. We're kind of a one-stop shop. We're kind of unique in the Army in that way, where we are the only ones that have a law enforcement mandate that do both the investigation and the forensic examination as well. So I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. And you may recognize Adam from NCIS from his cameos on the show.
Proby.
Yeah, good. So now it's your turn. Anybody have any questions? Let's kick this off. Okay, sir, please step up to the mic. Say your name, where you're from, and ask your question.
I'm Tyler. I'm a student at University of Berkeley. I noticed when you were describing your job description, the first thing almost all of you mentioned was child exploitation. Is this like the main priority when it comes to your divisions, and is this true across all federal agencies?
I guess I can start. Within the Air Force, I mean, we have a very limited number of computer or cyber skilled specialists that conduct investigations. And really, support to general crimes is actually one of our lower priorities. We probably dedicate very limited resources to doing that just because the growth of, you know, intrusion activity and the damage that that causes to our network. So that's probably becoming each year less and less something that's on our scope within the Air Force. You guys can definitely talk to what your entities are doing. I don't know if you're doing any of that.
I would say, obviously child exploitation cases are important because the folks that are doing that type of stuff need to be caught and need to be put behind bars. And we kind of refrain from saying what's a bigger priority than something else. I mean, it really just depends on the caseload. And we try not to push stuff away. So the only reason I mentioned the majority of our work is in the computer intrusion arena is because that's where the majority of the work is, not because we let it bubble to the top as a bigger priority. So, if the caseload is, five child exploitation cases and one computer intrusion case, so be it. If it's the other way around, so be it. It just depends on what activity services and how many, agents we have assigned to what stuff. But it's not, it's certainly not something that we say, we don't have time to run that case because we're doing this, because they are important cases as well.
Very similar, it's grab bag cases, whatever we get. Unfortunately, that is not a rare crime, and it goes across the scope of all our agencies. Prior, when I was with Customs, I was in a group solely devoted to child exploitation, and that was beyond just, looking at pictures on the internet. Those were people actively traveling to foreign countries to do things with minors. Unfortunately, it's just as popular as it was 10 years ago. It's just a crime that doesn't go away, and so I think we all devote a fair amount of time to that.
It's the same for us. My particular division, we focus on the intrusions, but we do have digital forensic examiners that are spread out across the country, well, across the world, really, that see a lot more of the child exploitation stuff, particularly the child pornography. One of the things about that crime in particular is that it gets a lot of public attention. It causes a lot of public outcry. It really gets a lot of media focus. So when you talk about something that pays the bills, so to speak, that's one of the ones that people like to focus on. And the reason for it is because, when you look at one hand, we're taking people that are actively preying on children, creating child pornography, sharing it around the world, and contributing to this type of victimization versus, we got a Romanian hacker that broke into a Department of Defense web server. I mean, the general public tends to care a little bit more about one than the other. As far as an agency priority, like the others, we don't really prioritize our crimes like that. We take what we've got, but it does receive a great deal of focus.
And I guess if I could just add, as far as priorities, it's not that it's less of a priority for my agency as a whole, more less of a priority for our cyber specialists because we're kind of constrained in terms of our efforts. So we're pushing those types of cases just to general agents and trying to get their cyber skill sets more, more advanced so that they can still take that mission forward. So,
thank you very much for your question. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your answer.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much. Very good question. Ma'am.
I was wondering how you got into the career. Were you computer scientists first and then you got recruited? Were you like law or justice majors and then you got trained?
Very good question, but what's your name and where you're from?
Linda Butler. been around.
Where are you from?
Yeah. That's a hard question for some people.
You had my kind of night last night then, because I don't know where I'm from right now, but. So, please.
Guys, do you mind if I start with this one?
Yeah.
You know, there's a real big debate in our field in general, particularly federal law enforcement for guys that do the cyber stuff. Is it easier to take a cop and turn him into a cyber guy, or is it easier to take an IT person or somebody who's a computer scientist and turn him into a good cyber cop? You know, it's kind of like the glass is half full or half empty debate. You know, less filling tastes great. It's one of those things that, and I'd like to ask the fellow panel members as you go down, I'd like to hear your opinion on that. Our consensus has generally been it's easier to take someone who was a cop or had a law enforcement background and turn him into a cyber guy because you can teach the cyber stuff, and it's a little tougher to teach some of the, you know, the intuition stuff, the following from point A to point B and being able to make that intuitive leap from B to D, you know, without going through C. But it's probably a product of where a lot of us came from. I was a cop first. I was a street cop. Started out in the military. Thought there had to be more than just writing speeding tickets. By then, I had already gotten a grad degree and a few other things and wanted to move up and move on. So I started looking at investigations very quickly, got focused on forensic science in particular, and then computer and digital forensics. After that was kind of how I got sucked in and decided that was where I wanted to make the rest of my career.
Cool. On the same note, I come from a law enforcement family. I was going to be a cop. I didn't go to school for it. I went to school, got a degree in psychology. I've been kind of geeky, but by comparison, I'm not so hot when I'm here. You know, I got into law enforcement and I started doing just regular general crimes, customs, you know, people smuggling dope, all sorts of things. And kiddie porn cases came up, and like we discussed, those are pretty prevalent. I got my feet wet there and doing the forensics, and I've always been involved in computers and interested in technology. And I got into it there, and I got a little more involved. On the same note as, you know, turning a cop into an IT guy, all of us, I think, are the same. We also have, you know, we're special agents. We have this job code. We also have other job codes. At least with NCIS, we have computer scientists. We have investigative computer specialists. Things that we bring to the table, we may not be computer geniuses, but what we bring to the table is we can go outside the office, go to your house, do the arrest, do the search. We bring a law enforcement angle to it. So we may not be the be-all, end-all when it comes to the computer investigations, but we also have other positions. Mm-hmm. So if you don't want to go out there and, you know, go through people's underwear in their house and things like that, there are other positions that you do the behind-the-keyboard kind of stuff, and you're doing the investigations from that side. But one of the benefits is that we can go outside and knock on doors and talk to people.
So your vote is cop first?
To a degree.
There's a lot of people. Take a stand, man.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
To a degree.
I don't know where I'd vote on that poll. I think you just need to be a geek that knows how to talk to people, honestly. And whether that comes as, you know, if you were a cop first or if you're a geek first, I'm not sure that, and in my mind, I don't think that matters too much. I mean, you have to have a passion for law enforcement. You have to have a passion for computer science or this industry. And if you have both of those things, you know, if you want to catch bad guys and like computers, whichever one comes first is, I think is irrelevant personally. I mean, because we have, and I'm sure Army does, I'm sure NCIS does, and I know OSI does, we have a little bit of both. We have a little bit of the geeks that became cops and then the cops that became geeks or nerds or whatever words you want to use. I don't have a background as a street cop first. My first, introduction to law enforcement was being a computer crime investigator, being an agent with OSI while I was in the Air Force. So my undergrad is in computer engineering, my master's is in computer science. You know, resume-wise, I'm probably the geek, but I like to talk to people. And I think that's the key skill set that you need to have outside of the geek stuff is like communication skills, absolutely.
Yeah, I think I'll win favor with the audience if I say you're way better off if you're a geek first. I guess I was one as well, so score one for me. But I came from an IT background. I did enterprise, NetOps, and security. And then through a friend of mine who, you know, was with the Air Force investigations, she pulled me in and I heard about it, and I've been thrilled, you know, doing this work ever since. But really part of it, and it kind of piggybacks on what a lot of people have said, is When I look at how we shape our force, there's no cookie cutter process. Really, we need people from a variety of backgrounds and expertise. So, you know, if I can get that guy that, you know, codes in a closet, he may be that team member that I need, but then there may be some guy that's just been a great street cop that balances that team out. And so, you know, you can't always just say it's one way, one path. We need people from all over the spectrum of geek, of law enforcement, of just creative thinkers. People skills generally are a must, being able to work with people and accomplish the mission through support. I mean, the reality is in law enforcement, I mean, we rely on the relationships we build to get our things done. There's just way too much stuff for us to work, and we rely on a lot of you to help us, and having those people skills really make that happen. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
So I'm Carney, I'm from Florida. When you're told to do a task that you morally disagree with, how do you handle that?
I haven't been in that situation yet, so.
Okay, if you were told to do a task that you morally disagree with, how would you handle that?
You know, something that you morally object to, I think I don't think the law enforcement aspect to it is any more or less relevant than just anything you do, any job you have. And you could work at Starbucks and be asked to do something that's, you know, that you object to. So, I would say you obviously try not to do it and try to talk your way through it with your supervisor so that you're not put in that position again. I don't know if anybody else has any other thoughts on that.
You know, there's plenty of avenues, for people that work with the government if they find themselves in a morally gray situation or something that they don't agree with, like, Ahmed, I haven't been placed in that position yet, but there's whistleblower laws, protections. A lot of time in my agency is spent on informing employees about courses that they can take if they're asked to do something that they don't feel is right, or they learn of something that they feel is criminal or morally objectionable, and ensuring that the employees are empowered to make the right decisions for themselves within the legal and regulatory framework of the federal government.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if I can address that question briefly, you could probably ask that question in any conference, in any venue, and you probably get similar answers. Morality is pretty much a personal choice, right? But as law enforcement officers, we also, you know, have a code of professionalism that's based on our individual organizations, and we uphold those professional ideals. And so morality is a personal choice, and we have the same venues for remedy in that environment as any other workforce. So thank you again. Sir, name and where you're from.
My name is Expro, and I'm from New Brunswick, Canada. And my question is, as cyber agents for each of your divisions, do you work with an informant base, and how would that differ from a traditional field agent if you do work with one?
That's a good question.
We do work with informants. It's actually not that different than a traditional field agent. One of the things that we experience a little bit more than probably the average general crimes agent at one of our outlying offices is we don't always have quite as much face-to-face interaction with the folks that come to our attention or become informants sometimes because of the nature of what we do. You know, sometimes we meet these folks online, and typically there's some sort of an interface that goes just beyond, you know, like chatting on the net, because it's difficult to verify identities and things. But we do talk to and recruit informants from all over the place, not only in what you would consider criminal elements, but also, you know, regulatory agencies, federal employees, corporate America, just all over the place. Sometimes they come to us, sometimes we go to them. It just depends.
And on that note, you know, since we represent a lot of the military organizations, we have locations overseas, different countries. And again, our cyber divisions in each one of our agencies are just a small fraction of our entire agency. So we might have one person who covers 10 states or two countries or five countries. So going back to what he said, the same thing. You know, if you're in California, but you're the next nearest guy to somebody in Utah, there's, you know, we have people who have sources in different states, and it's mostly electronic communication. I think that's the big difference, is just, you know, with a standard informant, you're meeting them face to face and exchanging things. With us, just using technology, doing it online.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add to that, and I know we don't each need to answer every single question because we're going to run out of time quick, but is usually our informants are usually good guys. I mean, if you compare the type of informants that, say, you know, somebody that works drug cases has, and not to say that all the informants in the drug world are bad guys, there's good guys there too, but typically they kind of have somewhat of a embattled history with drugs or access to drugs or those sorts of things. Whereas a lot of times in our case, I mean, the informants are just good guys that have access to information or that are willing to help. And they don't have to be criminals, and they never were criminals, and they never will be criminals. So that's probably the only distinction I'd make in the cyber world, is that the majority of our informants are good guys, too.
Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Sir.
Jeff from Rochester, New York. I go to RIT.
What's up, Chuck?
My question is, why would you choose government or federal work over doing federal contracting for, like, a third party? Like, why did you choose that?
Wow. My wife asks me that every day. Going back to the question the young lady asked earlier, you just have to have a passion for what you do. And I think all of us standing up here, in addition to having a passion for, you know, this industry, we have a passion for law enforcement. And it's kind of hard to, I think some of us have tried it. I mean, I did try the private sector for a while, and I enjoyed it. It was good work, but I was never personally as, you know, satisfied professionally or personally as I was when I was working in law enforcement arena. It's just, it's more of a passion than anything else. I mean, I suppose the money could be more or less, you know, really depends on the job or the type of job you have. But, if you're asking, you know, when you mentioned federal contracts, for me, it's not necessarily the stability or the security of the government versus federal contracts, because quite frankly, if any of you have been watching the news lately, the government really isn't that stable right now. I mean, there's a lot of money problems that are going on and budget issues that quite frankly scare me a little bit. And so I'm not sitting in the seat because it's a steady paycheck. I'm sitting in the seat because it's the line of work that I have a passion to do.
The contractor's positions just don't give me a gun, so that's my
reason. That too.
No, you know, being active duty, I love the people I work with, and I mean, that's a big part of it. Nothing against contractors. I work with a lot of phenomenal contractors as well, and you know, they're a part of the team. I'm proud of my military service, and you know, you got to weigh those options. There's advantages and disadvantages. There's headaches in working for the government and the bureaucracy that we deal with, and you know, so you kind of got to weigh what your interests are and what your you know, what you need best for the life that you want. So.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sir.
My name is Nick. I'm from San Diego. And,
cool.
Thank you for San Diego. Being here. Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you.
So my question's kind of it's kind of on the edge, and I apologize, but it's in regards to child pornography, which I think like publicly and statistically has kind of exploded, or for the most part. Now, like I assume when, you know, a police officer, you know, finds like a meth dealer or a coke head, they don't have to like physically, you know, get down there and take a line to find out it's cocaine. You know, there's labs and whatnot for that. But for, I mean, child pornography, in regards to like a conviction, how do you go about doing that? I would assume you have to expose yourself or a team to like a mass quantity of that.
We do. We see a lot of it. When I was with Customs, I think we were the first class. They started instituting a at least annual kind of well-being check to make sure that it wasn't affecting your life. And I know a lot of smaller, like police departments, local police departments, and other investigative agencies have started doing that. I know some places they limit it. You can only do it for 2-3 years and you have to get out. You can't make your career out of it in those places. A lot of it, you know, it's difficult. You do see a lot. But you kind of got to separate yourself from the situation, especially like in our line of business. You know, when you're dealing with counterfeiting or currency cases or dope cases, Like, when you see $20 million, you don't see that as $20 million. There's no temptation to, like, hey, I could take $5, put it in my pocket. Because it's evidence. You know, you kind of got to remove yourself from that situation and say that's not money, that's just evidence. And you kind of have to do that with the child pornography.
And, I mean, legally, you guys, I mean, is there, like, things, a process you have to go through, things you have to sign? I mean, because, I mean, it's almost redundant at that point. Like, you know, you're taking one thing from an area, and, you know, you're putting in another one. I know it's for the greater good, but it's still...
There's I don't mean to take up these guys, but, you know, I've done a decent amount of these cases. There's definitely a process, legal process, you know. In the legal process, if you're convicted or you're defendant in these cases, you know, you have the right to a defense. So there's ways and there's legalities to giving you access to the evidence. Because if you're in a dope case or some other case, your defense team has to have access to the evidence to review it to come up with a proper defense. But there are a lot of legalities. It's not so much just signing something. It's access control, where they can view it, how much they can view it. I know there's that case in the news of the guy who's defending himself from, I forget what state, but he's defending himself and he gets to look at his own child porn again, and that's kind of the odd duck, you know, it's not the everyday thing.
It is considered contraband, if that's what you're asking. Right. I mean, it's definitely controlled. It's not something that's just kind of hanging around in the office that everybody can see. You know, the process, the analysis, the forensics on the box, clearly articulating and showing what is considered child pornography, what's not. Some of that determination has already been made for us. There's repositories of hash values out there that of known images that have already been analyzed over and over and over again, so you don't have to dig through the image and get three or four different experts to look at it and say whether or not, you know, the individual in the image is underage or not. That's already been done. And so a lot of times it's just, you know, matching a value that's in a repository that's already been done a bunch of times, and if the count is high enough on those, and you have enough for a conviction, then, you know, obviously you still need to treat the other stuff and get the other stuff entered in the system. But you're not actually, in most cases, you're not taking those images and transferring those images to a repository. You're usually dealing with the hash values of those images.
Okay.
So you're not just sending child porn all over the place.
And as far as recent years, from like an actual reliable source, is it the contraband itself on the decline or is it still rising? In like say the United States.
You wouldn't happen to be a reporter, would you?
No,
because
no.
You've got the four question syndrome going on.
you can ask a lighter question if you like.
I'm just messing with you, but please go ahead.
You know, just real quick, I'm not aware of the particular statistics, but if we just apply a little common sense thought as technology gets better and better, you know, storage media gets larger and larger, transmission speeds get faster and faster, it's only reasonable to expect that crimes that depend on those things for their lifeblood, like child pornography and child exploitation, will become more prolific in society.
Cool.
All right, thanks, guys. Thanks for everything.
Yeah, thank you so much. Sir.
Hello, I'm Wesley from Seattle. Yeah, this is a yes or no answer. I think given the broad expertise, it's got a long way to help me with arguments that I have with colleagues and coworkers and whatnot. So if, in your opinion, if I was a search engine and I was collecting a lot of data from the web and it came to the point where I needed to decide whether or not to store content from sites that were proud of being preteen swimsuit models, that's what they did, so their non-membership areas were, well, we do preteen swimsuit modeling. In your opinion, yes or no, sorry to put you on the spot like this, but the yes or no just resolves a lot of issues for me. Would I want to be affiliated with these sites in any way? Would I want to index them and be appointed to them? Yes or no?
I wouldn't.
You know, I think for most of us up here, it's all about the letter of the law. If you read what the law says, what the United States, what in this country, what the United States Code has to say about what's permissible and what's not, it either is or it isn't.
Yep.
So I would take my cue from that because that is what we're all called upon to enforce.
Okay.
Got another reporter.
Can I just quickly follow that one more? So if it was your search engine and you were running it from your home, right? Given the experience that you have, so it's rights of admission reserved, I will decide who comes into my index. Would you store that content? So would you be the pointer to that? Would you index those sites from your personal experience?
I don't. I've never been put in that situation. That's a hypothetical. I mean, can't even.
Based on everything I've done, I wouldn't want to be associated with anything that's even remotely borderline suspect child pornography.
Hey, Wes, I'll give you one quick answer on that, just to, because I think you kind of want to know our personal opinions as well as. So I'm not a lawyer. I don't try to be a lawyer. And whenever there's that you know fine line of is this okay to move forward with or not on a case, I always call the lawyer, the prosecutors. I don't make those calls myself. But personally, if it were my own company and my business and had absolutely nothing to do with my professional career, I would probably avoid those sites myself.
Super. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Sir.
Hi, I'm Chris from Chicago. My question is, obviously, you guys, I don't want to go back to the child porn thing, but between violent crime or offensive images or whatever else, there's a lot of demands put on you by the job. How do you manage, or how do you really balance the demands of the job and what you actually go through in the course of your investigations with being a husband or brother or boyfriend or whatever else and having a real life?
Yeah, good question.
Very good question. Interesting question. I'm going to cry right now, actually.
I got to go call my family. Excuse me.
Just thinking about it and all the things I went through last night, actually, in the service of my country. But please.
There's always an overwhelming amount of work to be done in this industry, and I mean, you got to have priorities. And I mean, I have a family. I'm married, and. I'd love to say that I leave at 4 every day or that I leave at 5 every day. That does not happen, but, you know, I make it my priority to get home. You know, my career goals and things like that, I don't aspire to, you know, get to a certain level in the government. I aspire to, you know, retire one day and have a family that I can spend time with. And there's people that sacrifice a lot of that to get their retirement or to get to a stage that they want to be at. And you just have to have balance. I mean, I think balance in life is a very important thing, and you have to know your priorities and make sure that you kind of keep those in check. Because, I mean, the job pays the bills short term, but it doesn't necessarily take care of you long term. So,
same as Adam. I mean, family man, kids. You know, that work life balance is something that you're always working on, and I think everybody deals with that struggle, right? Work, whether you work 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day, you have an obligation requirement to your job as well as your family. And so just simply in the aspect of, okay, balancing, you know, your professional life and your personal life, everybody does it differently. But specifically, I think what you're asking is, you know, some of the day-to-day stuff that we see.
The baggage,
do,
like, the bad most
stuff,
people
right?
don't see.
Right, the baggage, the dealing with bad guys, seeing images that would otherwise probably, you know, damage you mentally in some regard, which I am mentally damaged, I think, at this point. But, no, you know, I try and turn it off. I really do I try and get home and turn it off. And it's hard sometimes. It really is, because you're home and you're with your kids and you're playing, you're watching TV, and, you know, you got, today's case running through your head, but you just do the best you can, like any other thing. I mean, something that I picked up recently on, it's funny you ask that, is, you know, I read so much at work, always reading, you know, whether it's investigative information or whether it's professional, you know, material whether it's for the case or to educate myself. I realized just last week that, man, I don't read anything for leisure, to just get my mind off of everything. And so I went out and bought a couple of books that have absolutely nothing to do with anything that I'm interested in, just to get my mind off of everything else. And, you know, just sit in bed when the kids are asleep and read that helps kind of turn things off as well.
I echo exactly what they said. And as a father, it just makes you, keep a more watchful eye on your kids. That's the only thing that's, I think, I've been different. And, of course, when they get old enough to use the Internet, I'll shut that off.
Thanks very much, guys. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Sir.
Hi, I'm RFG from Northern California. I just wanted to know to what extent federal law, in particular 18 U.S.C. 1030, affects what you guys are constrained from doing, or the extent to which it does not constrain you. And I was also curious about your working definition of federal interest computer.
I'm sorry, that last part
again? The whole question.
I was interested in your definition of federal interest computer, your working definition.
Well, the first part, I think, is easier to address. All of us act within the laws that have been passed by the government and the interpretation of those laws by the courts. Particularly in our organization, we have a policy. It's called CYA. In this case, it's not cover your rear. It's consult your attorney, as was brought up before. That is the golden rule in our organization. Everything that comes in goes through a senior counsel for us, and that's to help us as agents and investigators ensure that we're acting within the scope of the laws that exist, whether it be the Constitution or privacy laws or whatever the case may be. So we take that extremely seriously. Because all of us also, if we violate those, not only do we run the risk of losing a case, but we also open ourselves up to civil liability as well. So there's a great deal of focus on ensuring that we're acting within the law and we're doing everything legally. Someone else want to give a definition of federal interest computing?
No, I'll be honest with you. I don't even know what it is. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to pretend like I do. Can you tell us what it is?
It's part of federal law, basically. 18 U.S.C. 1030 has certain constraints relative to federal interest computers, and the exact definition of that term, I think, is open to interpretation.
You mean what constitutes a government computer versus a non-government computer?
A federal interest computer under the law.
Okay.
Basically, yeah.
What constitutes a computer that you guys are targeting?
What constitutes, like, if something, let's say you're doing an investigation and you trace something and it looks like it's on some server in, I'll just pick some place, Singapore.
Okay.
And it's theoretically or actually possible for you guys to penetrate that server in some sense, to access it without explicit authorization. Can you then do that, or are you constrained from doing that?
No. We're not authorized under most criminal code to penetrate any computer, regardless of where it is. Okay. You're getting that from when you start talking about that kind of stuff. You start talking about some computer network offensive and act.
Yeah.
That from under 18 USC. We can't do. Now what we can do is if it's a stateside, if it's a US-based computer or IP address or whatever, we can get search warrants to effectively get everything on that computer that would be the equivalent of logging in and taking it.
Right.
But if it's overseas, then we're at the mercy of the local law enforcement of wherever it is. So if it's in a country that's cooperative and is willing to help, then we can usually gain access to what we need. If it's in a country that doesn't want to help, well then But I mean, there's international, Interpol and those sorts of things that help with that if it's overseas. But we're not penetrating anything. We don't do that.
Well, I have to apologize profusely. I really appreciate your questions, but I didn't come armed today, and the goons are getting ready to pull us off the stage. So I don't have any other remedy except to leave.
We are going to the Q&A room right down the hall. Make a right out here. Go almost all the way down. It's on your right hand side. You guys will be in that room for almost an hour.
Okay, so
we sent some people down there, and just so you know, somebody from the press actually was requested in that room. If anybody in the press wants to go down there, knock yourself out.
But I just want to say thank you so much for coming. It's a great opportunity to be able to interact with you, and hope to see you around.